This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Thank you for coming. It is an honor to be a part of this weekend. We are calling it a Creation Care Weekend. Tomorrow is particularly titled The Butterfly Project. Hopefully you have heard that phrase, and that's part of why you've come to this. So we'll have a lecture tonight, and then tomorrow we'll have an art exhibit. You've already gotten a sneak peek of it as you've walked into the house. A poetry reading, some more teaching, a shared meal, a really special Libri Day that you are welcome to come to for a part or all of it. It is a great honor for me to introduce to you Peter and Miranda Harris. They are originally from England, but back in the 1980s, they began a Christian conservation organization. Does that sound like a beautifully odd idea to you? And exactly right. So that was back in the 80s, and it began in Portugal. And so it bears a Portuguese name. Maybe you've seen this phrase but weren't quite sure how to pronounce it. It's called a rocha, which means the rock. And they are co-founders of this organization. And the name was both echoing your geological interests and the geology of the place where you were beginning, I believe, as well as the reference in the scriptures to Jesus as the rock. So there's a dual meaning there. This started in the 1980s, but has grown into an international movement that I'm sure we will hear more about. My connection with Arasha began just 5 or 6 years ago. I was taking a graduate course at Regent College in Vancouver, and it was co-taught by Regent professors and Arasha staff. That was my introduction to them, my introduction to Peter's books, all of which you can get on Amazon at a good price, I've heard. And that course was transformative for me and really for my family. So it's a personal honor to welcome you both tonight and tomorrow. You guys are heroes in the world of conservation, and more particularly conservation in the name of Christ. So thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for being with us this weekend. So let's welcome together Peter Harris.
Thank you very much for your welcome and the welcome of all the community here, particularly the people who know how to run a Mac computer, because as always happens, Macs don't speak to projectors and vice versa, and they've been swearing at each other in various languages, but we're up and running. It was purple 15 minutes ago, so this Heidi, to whom we owe our particular presence here, I think, tonight, would never have forgiven us if she'd have seen what that looked like purple. So, anyway, it all works now, so thank you. We also owe a debt of gratitude to the Libri movement as a Rocha, in fact, in an explicit way. So I was a student in Cambridge, the original Cambridge, in the early 1970s. And first encountered the writings of Francis and Edith Schaeffer. And for the first time, without boring you with my personal story, I think it was the first time that I heard a coherent articulation, first of all, of the fact that some kind of environmental concern was going to be an integral part of Christian thinking, with a book, actually a genuinely pioneering book called, and prophetic book called, Pollution and the Death of Man. And no Christian that I had come, because I hadn't read the Church Fathers, and actually there's a huge literature about this all the way from the get-go of Christian thinking, but I'd never really come across that kind of Christian thinking about such a contemporary issue, because it was just then, with the Silent Spring and Rachel Carson and the devastating effect of pesticides, that are now being visited on us all, actually. If we did an analysis of everybody here in this room, you would be amazed at what you're carrying around with you. But Schaefer saw this coming, and he understood that actually that word pollution is spiritually freighted, and nailed it in saying that essentially the ecological problem is a human problem, and as a human problem, it's a spiritual problem. And this was completely new to me, but also not just, and this is part of, I think, what this weekend is about with Heidi, which Miranda and I are so thrilled to be part of, also understood that Christian engagement with culture is, of course, essential to our character as well. Because I'd grown up in a slightly ghetto-like Christian environment, which I ran away from in Thailand, but that's a whole other story. And I think that it was deeply encouraging to discover that. And then the community insights of Le Brie came to mean a lot to us both personally. I think Miranda visited, when were you, think in the 70s? Probably. About 3 weeks ago, actually, we were in the next valley over to Wemo, but we didn't know you guys were there, otherwise we would pottered over. Sorry about that. I was too busy looking for wall creepers in the higher Alps. But anyway, I'm afraid that is true. And it, when people used to say at the beginning, what, you know, tell us what Arosha is, there were no Christians doing, as we were, banding birds, studying marshes, you know, actually involved hands-on in conservation. And so we used to say, well, if you think of it like a kind of ecological Le Brie, you won't be too far wrong. Because we were living in community with the students. We were making community with all comers, whatever they believed. And by the way, tonight, I'm not assuming everybody here shares my own Christian faith. That's really important. And I like robust discussion, so let's have that in the very generous hour that I gather we might have. But that community emphasis, that relational emphasis that Miranda will talk about tomorrow, Le Brie was formative for us in that. And at different times we've met Le Brie people all over the world. And we're very grateful, therefore, to kind of come back to the mothership a little bit and see if you approve, or if you don't, which could be better. So I've called this the butterfly effect of the gospel, with a nod obviously to Heidi's wonderful work that you'll be hearing more about, and just to put one of her pictures straight up there. But essentially, the point I'm going to be making the whole way through is that we all can easily, living in a Western and dualist culture, assume that good news, this Christian gospel, addresses a limited range of issues, what we've come to think of as the issues of personal spirituality. But this is doing violence to what historic Christianity has ever been about. And let me give you one cracking example straight away. But this is the grandson of a friend of ours called Simeon, who is very proud when we get to begin talks by showing him. He has, as you can see, Down syndrome. I think that's the term you maybe use in the USA. And so when taken to buy glasses, in his view, when you go to a shop, if you can get one thing, it's good, but if you can get more, it's much better. So he, this was his idea of bliss. And he was all set for walking out of the shop with this. But this is essentially, for me, a metaphor of how we can so easily read our Christian traditions or our Christian texts through a number of different lenses. I bring tonight, as you can probably guess, the lens of being Brit, so you're going to have to forgive me for a number of things, the lens of my white ethnicity, the lens of having lived in Latin cultures for 30 years, which is why we'll probably overrun. No, we won't, but anyway. But we all bring to both our biography and our reading of Christian tradition or other traditions and Christian texts a number of filters. Let me give you one example right to start with. So this is an early Genesis text. It's all biblical material apart from the title in bold. And this is the first agreement that God makes. And those who produced this version of the Bible, the New International Version, titled it. That's not in the text. And they said, this is God's covenant with Noah. In other words, there's a person in this story, so that's the point of the story. Now, that kind of idea comes out of the Enlightenment, it comes out of humanism, it comes out of a particular way of seeing the world. It's certainly not what the text is telling us. And just to make that easy, I've put some things in bold and in yellow. Seven times in this text it says the agreement is between God and all of life, between every creature on earth. Just in case you think it's only the animals of interest to people, it's the birds. You'll see that this covenant is about everything, and yet the gloss is it's going to be with the person in the story, because we have made the Christian story our story. And the same thing has happened in environmental thinking in the West too. What does the term the environment say? It implies whose environment? Whose environment? Our environment. What do most governments around the world have? They have a Department of Natural Resources. Resources for who? Resources for us. What's ecosystem services about? The dominant thinking of how to value nature now in the whole conservation movement. Ecosystem services for people. Yeah. It's what nature does for us. How do we value nature? Because of what it does for us. It's been reduced to this tiny little thing. But the gospel is the opposite. It has a butterfly effect. The butterfly effect, if I understand it well, and I know there's some bright people in the room, so feel free to contradict me. I've studied in Cambridge. I like being contradicted. That's where we're up and running. As far as I understand it, it's the understanding of physics which says if a butterfly shakes its wing in one part of the world, the effects are perhaps felt in a tsunami in another. That's to say, everything is absolutely connected. And if Christian understanding of the world is telling us anything, it's that everything is connected to everything else. And what I want to do tonight is just explain to you how we, in Arusha around the world, understand the roots of this absolute crisis that we're in ecologically, and how it's fundamentally a crisis of the broken relationship between people and their creator, but it's spilling out ecologically all around the place. And yet there is, as in consequence of that, because it's gospel, because it's good news, there is some kind of hope. Is that okay so far as a kind of sketch? Does anybody have any questions or anything they would like to take issue with? Straight away, apart from the state of these things which got ripped in brambles trying to find a warbler in Central Park yesterday, but that's another story too. any questions, any problems or issues? Okay, we'll press on. So I want to give you a kind of quick outline of some biblical thinking about what is going on in terms of our relationship to the rest of the created world. It's a kind of summary, but trust me, but underneath this, there's a lot of reputable theology. I'm a journeyman generalist, and I magpie stuff from all over, but it has been road tested with the great and the good. So the first understanding, I'm not proof texting here, the first thing is that the understanding of being human is that to be human is to have some kind of care for the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the livestock, over all the earth and over all the creatures. So there are two big Hebrew terms, two big Hebrew verbs, to keep and to serve. Man was in the garden, mankind, that's male and female, to keep, shamar, and to serve, avad, the garden. That is our human identity. The first thing you know about being human is we're responsible for taking care of all of this. So if we sense that things are not right, we do have a particular responsibility in that. It's a human problem. And what we're taking care of is not ours. It is not natural resources. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And this is like a kind of drumbeat idea that you pick up from the beginning to the very end of Scripture. I want to say that when our road into Arusha came in different ways, partly because I was just born with binoculars around my neck, partly because of a love of Hebrew and the Hebrew scriptures, and beginning to see how some of these texts were not talking about what I'd been always told they were talking about. They were talking about the whole of creation. And this idea is a biblical idea that arcs from the beginning to the end of Scripture. If you want to go looking for Christian thinking, you don't have to proof text little bits from Minor Prophets about frogs or anything. It's just all over. It's all over the whole story. The story begins with the creation and ends with the new creation. It doesn't begin with man's predicament, his sin, and end with his personal salvation. We find our place within a biblical narrative of creation through catastrophe and to new creation. It's a completely different arc of narrative. And this idea is a foundational one, that the earth is the Lord's and everything is in it. So those of you who work for Labri will be familiar with our financial predicament in Arusha, which is that you frequently have to borrow stuff or you get given stuff or whatever. If stuff is other people's stuff, you tend to look after it better. At least that's what we always try to tell our kids. You know, don't dent this car. It belongs to X, you know, and we want to give it back. There was one time I went to buy a second-hand kayak with my son, with a borrowed car from another Christian. And we didn't have a roof rack because we worked for Arusha. So we put this kayak gently inside the car between the two seats like that. And I lowered the back seat, the back window like this, boom. And there was a kind of thud and the front windscreen went out like chomp, with 100 different pieces. And we'd borrowed the car for 12 hours to get the kayak. And this is, you know, this is the stuff that happens. But the car is Carl's. Give it back. As it was. The earth is the Lord's. It's not natural resources. We are not in a position of autonomy with how we... We're in a position of a relationship with how we deal with the earth. And in fact, if that's the essential outline, that what is the Lord's, this is just one of many Old Testament passages where the analysis of what's gone wrong is very, very clear and very shocking. And as you read this, I want you to remember this is 3,000 years before the idea of a marine crisis was ever upon us. We live now with depleted and plastic-ridden and pollution-ridden seas, as you'll see in a moment. But Hosea was saying here, if the relationship with God is broken, it won't just lead to the kind of moral breakdown that we know, cursing, lying and murder, stealing and adultery, the dysfunction, the bloodshed, the breaking social bounds that is the very familiar home ground, if you like, of Christian preachers. But there's this consequence. Because of this, the land mourns, says Hosea. Yeah. All who live in it are wasting away. The beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea are dying. This is extraordinary. Mm. Mm. To the Hebrew mind, the sea was chaotic and went on forever. How could the fish of the sea possibly be dying because of how people in this particular land of Israel were treating each other? Mm. Well, now we're beginning to understand this. And so we're just going to have a gloomy moment now, if you don't mind. Miranda and I were at a rather bizarre do, actually, in London, where it was kind of a record launch. But the head of the World Wildlife Fund was there, WWF was there. And I learned something from him that night because he had 5 minutes to do his pitch to the great and the good of London. And he said, look, bear with me, I'm just going to be really gloomy for a minute. And he ran them through it for 2 minutes. And I thought, well, you know, you're right, we have to do this. So at the beginning of this week, the UN finally published their global report on biodiversity. I don't know if you saw it, so I've just lifted a few headlines. So we know about the situation with plastic that is omnipresent. We know about it quite personally, actually. Miranda partly grew up in East Africa. Mm-hmm. And when she was a child, swimming off the East African coast was glorious. It was like the Disney pictures. It was multicolored fish everywhere. Mm. I hope you weren't going to talk about this tomorrow. I don't think you were. Were you?
Yes, I was.
Oh, gosh. No. Anyway. All right. Anyway. So when she was growing up, the sea off the East Africa was this wonderful paradise of species and whatever. And we were there just 2 or 3 years ago with mats of plastic and bleached coral reef and very few species to be found. And this is in our lifetime. The fish of the sea are dying. This is what the report has just been telling us about biodiversity decline. So in the lifetime of Labri, and pretty much in the lifetime of Arusha, we've actually lost half of life on Earth. Not species, but but living organisms. We've actually lost half of life on Earth in the lifetime of our organisations. And this is essentially the simple decline in wildlife populations that's been going on since 1970. 67% decline is projected by next year. So you're nearly up to three quarters of life on Earth. We are the first generation that has a clear picture of the value of nature. I would contest that. I don't think wider society has any idea why nature matters, and that's part of the problem. And there's a big argument about it, as I was saying, between those who think it matters because we need it and those who think it just matters and we can't explain why. But anyway, WWF is a bit more confident than me. They're saying we have a clear picture of the value of nature and our impact on it. We may be the last that can take action to reverse this trend. From now until 2020 will be a decisive moment in history. Till next year. So one in four species are currently at risk of extinction. You'll be happy to know that the head of the commission and the project that produced these statistics is Simon Stewart, who's a wonderful committed Christian and actually on the Arosha board. These figures are very solid, they're expert peer-reviewed stuff. But look at those percentages, percentages of different groups that are at risk of extinction. You're pretty much up to half. And if you like frogs, get out there and look at them because, you know, you haven't got so long. My grandchildren almost certainly will not know what a living coral reef is anywhere in the world. If you look at the situation with biodiversity loss and deforestation, looking at Bahia in 1990, and it's down, missed a slide, but basically that was green and it goes to that you saw there. That was essentially a green state. And it's very interesting, this situation with insects, because one of the things we're discovering in many of the studies emerging now is that what we thought of as pristine tropical forests are also missing huge percentages of their populations of insects. And remember that you can try and say you want to save the forest, but without pollinators, you're not going to. And some of the critical studies on insect loss were done in German nature reserves over a 25-year period. And this is how it turns out, with the green figures 1989 compared to the red in 2013. And that's in 53 nature reserves. So I think it was Einstein who said, without insects, you can't feed people. We need these pollinators. So even if you are taking that narrow anthropocentric view, we need nature, then it's insane to be doing what we're doing. And trust me, there are still huge lobbies fighting the banning of neonicotinoids and the things which we know are just wiping insects out globally in the most indiscriminate fashion. Okay, so that was our gloomy moment. But Hosea saw it all coming down the pipe. Very clearly, as did Jeremiah, as did Isaiah, as did many, many of the Old Testament prophets. There were always ecological consequences to our personal behaviour. So this is where we can lift our heads a little bit, and it's a complicated thing, I can tell you, working in this field and living with this, because honestly, many of the drivers of what we were just looking at seem to be kind of baked in to the ecosystem now, certainly in terms of the carbon in the atmosphere. Unless we do something genius and figure out a way of pulling it out, that atmospheric change has taken place, and climate will change, because it's going to be 1,000 years until the carbon will be gone, even if we stop putting it there. And so this is where the thing gets quite pointed, and this is an essential Christian idea, which is that we may be, if we're Christians, familiar with the idea of an extraordinary personal transformation. We have somebody close in our family who people have said over the years, oh, Arosha, that they no longer care about whether people come to know Christ or not. They're just these eco warriors or whatever. We have in our family somebody who would, if the rest of his not family is to be compared, be in utter chaos had he not become a Christian at the age of 17. And we really have seen in many people, and in ourselves slowly and painfully, the extraordinary personal transformation possible through knowing God. At the time when I was a working minister, I was studying scripture with four convicted murderers in a prison at one point. And this amazing hope for everybody of transformation. But the incredible news from Romans 8 is the whole of creation is going to be drawn into this final transformation and redemption. We have no idea how that happens or what that's about, but it's a very firm idea. In hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. And New Testament scholars have told me that that bondage, that slavery of creation, that frustration of creation is essentially us. We are what is doing that. And part of the liberation is that creation will be set free from our impact and given its glorious freedom in the same way as we personally can be set free from the drivers of decay in our own personal experience and lives. And I want to now make this really quite practical, because when we called Arosha Arosha, it's true that the understanding of ecology at that time was kind of ground up. The rocks you had determined the soil you had, the soil you had determined the plants and then the insects and then on upwards. But our contemporary understanding of ecology has flipped to the idea of what's known as trophic cascades. That's to say the keystone predators, the top predators, determine how things play out. There was this very famous example you probably know of in Yellowstone, where there was a controversial decision to reintroduce wolves. But the effect on that was to bring the park back to life, because all the herbivores were grazing it down to the rock and nothing was taking them out. Once the wolves came, it wasn't simply that they were reducing the populations of deer and other things to reasonable limits, but that they were excluding them from areas and allowing the vegetation to recover. And the park literally came back to life. And we've come to understand, as I've been explaining so far, that we are the ones who are having this impact on the world around us. I put this there. This is a shame that your son isn't here. He would kind of like this picture, and I'm rather pleased with it too. But anyway, this is a red-tailed hawk, and it's a little bit of a cheat. So I have banded some tens of thousands of birds in my life, and one of the nicest experiences is banding migratory hawks on the Appalachian Trail just north of Hawk Mountain. So this is a hawk coming in to... My friend says about the pigeons that the lure wrapped in a nice little leather jacket, but he wouldn't answer for them psychologically. But anyway, this is what you see if you're the bait in one of these traps. And I'm in there with my little camera watching them come in. Predators can be told because of where their eyes are on their head. If you're a hunted species, you have your eyes on the side of your head so you can see what's about to drop on out of the sky and kill you. If you're a hunter, you really don't care because you're just killing things. So where are your eyes? We are the top predator. And we live in what people call the Anthropocene. And this is just the demonstration of that, really. These are the drivers of species loss. Habitat degradation, we do that. Exploitation, we do that. Invasive species and disease, how do they get around? They get around on our ships and planes and the engineering we do. When we opened up the Suez Canal, all of those Indian Ocean species flooded into the Mediterranean and carnage. Climate change, of course, and pollution. These are the main drivers of what's going on by percentage in all of these taxa, from birds to reptiles and amphibians, mammals and fish. This is us. Now, to make this even more particular, the coloured parts of the map represent what's known as the biodiversity hotspots. Biodiversity hotspots have been identified as essentially the slightly less than 2% of the planet's surface that holds about 70 to 80% of its biodiversity. So it's a very, very, most of it, as you'll notice, is in the global south. It's a very small part of the Earth which is holding this extraordinary diversity. If we were to walk, if we were in Brazil, where your centre is, and this was woodland around, and we walked out after breakfast, there would be hundreds and hundreds of species, and many of them undescribed. But what nobody had done until we funded this study was asked, okay, so if people are causing all of this, and they're doing it because essentially what they believe about the world around them, in other words, if they believe that what's around them is the raw material of economic growth, they're just going to extract it till it's gone. That's how the markets work. Therefore, what do the people who live in the biodiversity hotspots believe? And in specific terms, we wanted to know, what was the Christian presence in those parts of the world? And more specifically, our tribe, which in shorthand are called evangelicals, but those who take the Bible seriously or authoritatively. That, incidentally, is not the bit we're going to argue about in the hour we've got left when I start speaking. But the definition of evangelical is for a later speaker on another occasion. But anyway, and I know it's got all kinds of baggage in all different parts of the world. So, but what was interesting is that actually, very often, these stakeholders, the human stakeholders in the biodiversity hotspots, are not just Christians. They're Christians who claim to believe the Bible. So going back to my early slide, if we're reading the Bible through the lens of what does the Christian good news have to give me in my life as a kind of spiritual accessory to get me to heaven or to enable me to break out of poverty or to heal all my diseases, or, you know, if it's that view of God for me, then we all have a problem. And in particular, this study was co-funded by Conservation International. It's not just Christian thing. When I went to see the head of Conservation International at the time in the early 90s, I think this was, or late 90s, he said there's two real threats to biodiversity on Earth. One is big business, unregulated business, big business. The other is evangelical theology. Because he understood that global churches were teaching people, Jesus is coming back, it's all going to burn, so why does it matter? Or as somebody said to us in a church in a part of the world that I won't name, if the rivers are going to turn to blood, why bother cleaning them up? That sense that we're just kind of going to... D.L. Moody said it. He said it's like the Titanic. Let it go down. Just get the people off the decks. That is a very, very common Christian view around the world. And if it is a Christian view in a place where biodiversity is concentrated, it's lethal. It's absolutely lethal. And we see, we are often in, I don't know, we discuss this. How many countries are you? You can give the authorized version. Typically, I would say we're in about, it depends on the year, but something like 12 to 15 countries every year. And we frequently see the consequences of the church in that part of the world preaching that if you're going to be a Christian, you're going to get rich, which means the more stuff you have, the happier you're going to be. And that's God's purpose for your life. This is just not authentic Christianity. This is the genetically modified gospel. No, because that DNA of a consumer, individualistic society has got so woven into Christian thinking and good news that it's something utterly different. It's not what Christian belief has ever been about. And it's vital that this message of a biblical faith starts to become normal for Christians around the world. The interesting thing is, I think people in the secular conservation movement understand why that's vital better than the Christian church does. At least they're the ones who are funding us to do a lot of it, not our Christian brothers and sisters. Money is key to this. And there's very little Christian giving goes into environmental anything. In fact, very little Christian giving leaves the countries where the wealth is generated. I think in your country, less than 4% of philanthropy ever leaves the USA. And certainly, I don't know what percentage of Christian philanthropy goes to environmental things, but my guess is it's a fraction of 1%. So, seen another way, this is an amazing message of hope. Because if Christians around the world start to understand that if you're farming, God doesn't just care about the people you employ, but about the land you're farming, and that you leave it in a better state than when you got it from your father. If the Christians around the world understand that when you're investing or when you're in business, your calling is to bless the creation and not just the people, then there's tremendous potential, because look at the presence of Christians where the blue, incidentally, is over 10% evangelicals. That's not even looking at Orthodox or Catholics who are even more present. So it's a remarkably practical thing. And to make this very visible, I just want to show you now a series of very hopeful, in my view, examples of what happens when the gospel gets written not just in people's lives, but in landscape. So we've done a little bit of reminiscing tonight, but if you'll permit me a teeny bit more, Miranda and I and our family moved to a house just there in 1983 to set up a bird observatory in a field study centre. And the team who've been fully led by our Portuguese brothers and sisters since the mid-90s, so after 10 years it passed over to national leadership as always intended, and with great grief we then moved on. Because Christians have been present, that ecosystem is still there and functioning. Some are even less probable. Very happily, our international chief exec for the last 10 years has been Chris Naylor, and he and his family lived for 20 years in the Middle East and for most of those years in Lebanon. And when he first showed us this area in the 1990s, I took that photograph, and this was supposed to be the most important wetland in the country. And as you can see, it doesn't look terribly wet. And it isn't just the time of the year. It had all kinds of problems. People were shooting eagles out of the sky literally in front of us. There was massive issues with pollution and land. And now it looks like that.
Wow.
And that is actually because of sustained Christian presence in the area, doing scientific studies, doing work with kids, persuading landowners that this is really important, persuading the government that this is really important. It's a complicated story. There's now over 1 million Syrian refugees in the Bekaa Valley. And it's a very complex story, because actually frequently wartime situations are good for the environment, particularly minefields do wonders for habitat protection, as you can imagine. Unfortunately, I'm not joking. But it's a complicated story, but this is a sign of hope. An interesting footnote about this, and this is very near, remember, to where the biblical writers were writing. Wetlands all over the world don't really belong to anybody, mainly because of malaria. Lebanon is kind of parceled out between Druze areas and Shiite areas and Maronite areas and Sunni and all the rest of it. But of course the Bekaa Valley in the wet areas was kind of where everybody could come. So we've been able to run a project for all comers there, because nobody's going onto anybody else's bit of Lebanon. But we are in kind of hunkered down mode while this current crisis lasts. But it's wonderful that the international effort is now led by Chris, who did such extraordinary work there for 20 years in really getting this place to look as it should. And in Kenya we had a slightly different problem around the Mida Creek and the Arabuka Sakoke forest. Essentially, the coastal forest of Kenya used to extend about 4,000 kilometres from Mozambique in the south right up to Somalia, and it's now reduced to essentially 40 kilometres of forest only that's left, tiny fragments. And lots of millions of USAID money and international aid money had gone into trying to protect the forest, but it wasn't having any impact. And one of the reasons was, and this I think will resonate with you all, a breed thinking, when we commit to a place, we're there. We belong in the community, we're not going anywhere, it's a long-term commitment. And also, our way of working is that we are empowering local groups with local leadership to become part of La Rocha. We don't plant projects with expatriates anywhere. And so what became apparent as our Kenyan team began to live and work in the area was that the reason people were chopping the trees down was to pay for secondary school for their kids. Because if you don't get to secondary school, which at the time was paid in Kenya, you're going to be poor for life. So the trees were being sold for charcoal or for carvings for tourists. So once you understand why this is going on, then you can begin to address the question. And essentially, what we did was work with the local hotels and the forestry department and everybody else and charge an admission fee for access to the forest, all of which went to paying school fees. So the forest essentially became the banker for the school fees. And any kid who gets a bursary from this then becomes an advocate within their school for starting a tree nursery, for explaining why that matters. And now we have 400 kids who've already gone right the way through the system. Some of the university graduates are now working for La Rocha Kenya, and it just works. And it's a sign of hope. And we were there, and the Muslim leaders, because it's primarily a Muslim community, said to us, you do realize that La Rocha has transformed our place. But what's transformed the place is Christian good news. Christian good news is for places, not just people. And it works. It takes you to the time to figure out what was happening. This was in London. Big debate on this. This is the most heavily populated borough of Britain. Mostly Sikh, Muslim and Hindu, because it's just at the end of the bus line from our main airport, Heathrow. So when people arrived, that's where they thought. And this was Southall. And on this last bit of space, there were plans for a supermarket, yet not a football ground, I don't know, a whole bunch of other prestige projects. But we censused 25,000 homes in the borough, led by the Anglican minister who was by then working for La Rocha, and found that what everybody wanted, because it was mostly the rural poor who had ended up in Southall, was green space. So it used to look like that, but a million of public money afterwards, it now looks like this. And the country park is 70 acres, and they've done it on another site now that we visited not long ago called Wolf Fields, which was essentially, in fact, even recently, until recently, there were Syrian refugees sleeping rough there, but it was a place for drug dealing and all kinds of stuff, and it used to look like that. And now, with a massive community project led by the Christians in the community, but in strict partnership with all the other faith leaders and groups, it now looks like this, and we had a wonderful public opening, and it's a public nature reserve for environmental education and teaching people how to grow food and all kinds of stuff. And this is giving me great joy now, because in one sense the dream is beginning to show itself. I just read on the train up here today our latest metrics from last year's work. Over a million hectares now globally are being managed in relationship with La Rocha. And I find that extraordinary. We're beginning to be able to see what we do from space. No, I'm serious. You can see it from space. So at a landscape level, we've been leading the national campaign in Ghana to save the Etewa Forest, which E.O. Wilson listed as one of the top 30 ecological sites left in the world. This is what it should be. Good news should be seen at landscape level, because conservation, we now understand, has got to happen at landscape level. You cannot just have nature reserves. The nature reserves in the USA now, at this time of the year, are half or more empty, because the migrants arriving have to spend the winter in places that no longer work for them ecologically in Central and South America. It's got to be a landscape approach. It can't just be us in our small corner making something beautiful. Conservation isn't like that. And so it goes on. We're beginning to operate at more scale. This is the view from our French centre where Heidi did quite a bit of her work on the butterfly paintings at Colmette. And this is, you know, a fair-sized site. This is the biggest private property in the Côte d'Azur. It's 600 hectares of hillside and mountain and forest. And it was a Christian centre and foundation that was basically going bust, who realised this place has to have an ecological vocation. And so we were placed, as our French director said, between two madnesses. The madness of taking the place, because it's a huge, frankly dilapidated building with accommodation for about 60 or 70 people. And the madness of not taking it, because what an opportunity. And it's been a huge fight and battle, I must say, but we're really getting there now. And there's a tremendous team and even some decent funding to do some of the essential renovations, and it's now beginning to really work well. And we've mostly funded it over the last decade by using it as a wedding venue, because you have to do what you have to do. But we're hanging in there, and now it's bearing fruit. I'm sorry that I said this. I just believe it very firmly. So here we go. That our worship and our work and our witness will be incomplete until our responsibility to conserve the glorious God-given diversity of Earth's creatures becomes second nature. Now that second nature thing is important. Recently, I was listening to a terrific biblical theologian whose work I admire greatly, but he just kept the consequences of all the great stuff that he was talking about to what happens to people and human societies and human communities. And I was intemperately sort of bouncing up and down on my seat and wanted to. And creation, it's not yet second nature for Western biblical believing, Christian believing, to understand that it all matters for everything and not just for us personally. And it's got to become instinct. And I'll explain some of the ways in which that's going to make a difference. This is just a kind of snapshot case study. One of the projects we've been running in Uganda is putting in a very simple biosand filters to provide drinking water in a very poor area of Kampala associated with a wetland where we're also working. And this is just doing the sums on this. So essentially, a biosand filter is going to cost you about $40. And 25 people from about 5 households can pour this foul water in the top and get drinking water out the bottom. It's just a box with sand in it, essentially. It will save them, those 25 people, on average, $1,550 on medical bills or on buying charcoal to boil their water, which is the only other alternative. It will save on the charcoal 33 trees getting chopped down. And if you can put in 950 biosand filters, you're looking at saving 28,000 trees or buying 57,000 charcoal bags. Now, this looks like a kind of business to me. It's costing you £40, $40, and it's saving you all of the rest. So at the moment, we're still operating as a charity in that regard. We're asking people to fund a biosand filter. We run a thing called Gifts with a Difference at Christmas. Instead of giving a gift, you can give a biosand filter to somebody, as it were, which will then be installed in Uganda. But I think what we could do is operate a system of loans of $40, which could then be paid back from the savings that the founders get. And then it's exponentially possible, because philanthropy is very limited. I could perhaps persuade 1,000 people to buy a biosand filter. But if I have a business making money, it's going to go like wildfire. And there's a lot of interest now in finding business solutions for biodiversity. And in my own working life, I'm spending a lot of time with investors, investment funds, trying to help people, first of all, figure out, if they're Christians, the importance of wealth creation that blesses creation instead of depleting it. And actually, we don't really know how to do that yet. But in the area of social development, we're getting quite a long way towards knowing how you can make money and help people's lives get a lot better. One classic example is the mobile phone. The mobile phone has spread like wildfire through Africa now. It leapfrogged landline technology. You can do all your banking on your phone. You can find out the true market price of stuff on your phone before you take it to the market. You can do tons with it. People have made shed loads of money out of mobile phone technology in Africa. So it's gone everywhere. if it had been a charitable project, chances are you wouldn't be able to get the parts. There'd be three in Kigali or somewhere and whatever, you know. So I do think that finding good profit is a great way to get us to the next stage in doing something. And that, again, is the butterfly effect of the gospel. If you are in business and you don't just think, so this is a means to an end for me and my family, and then I will be generous to Christian causes. Mm. I know many foundations who say, there's been no understanding that the narrative is from the creation to the new creation, mm-hmm. because it's about everything, because God doesn't just care about people, he cares about their places, and he cares about everything in their lives, cultural, artistic, their business life, the whole thing. And the loss of that, you know, that hold on the creational significance of the good news is what's impoverished and thinned out Western Christianity to a kind of lifeboat message, which is far, far from what Jesus was talking about with the kingdom of God. And of course, to your work this weekend, this affects how we co-create with the living God, with our artistic endeavour as we serve God, the artist. And one of the most exciting parts of Arosha at the moment, I think, is the way that artists are beginning to join us, because I think the conservation movement in general has been very techie. It's been very science, very left brain, very kind of, here's the data, so change, you know. But people don't change because you show them a spreadsheet, frankly. Well, I know. Firstly, I don't know which way up a spreadsheet is, but anyway, it's not transformational, is it? And when God engages with us, he engages with our whole person, with our heart, with our mind, with that wholeness of us as creators, as co-creators. And we want to be able to tell some of these stories, which I've told very inadequately and verbally tonight, to people's hearts through beauty and through celebration. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that a bit more tomorrow afternoon. But we're thrilled that Heidi's, as it were, decided in her heart that she wants to contribute her gift of painting to celebrating creation and drawing attention to what Arosha does, because I'm sure there are many people who are going to understand it that way who won't understand it this very wordy way that I have. And it's musicians too. We're going on next week to Nashville, where our international board are meeting, because over the last 5 years a number of professional musicians have committed to writing new music for the church that is creation friendly, that's not tending to say, I don't love anything else, I just love Jesus and I can't wait to go and be with him in heaven, which is much of what we sing is essential, you know, Buddhism basically or something. It's really difficult being in church because I'm required often to sing stuff that is not fundamentally Christian in that sense. And so they're revisiting old hymns, which do much better justice often to this. They're revisiting the biblical text and they're writing new music, and that's why we're going to Nashville to be with them. But there's lots of others around the world who are doing things too in that regard, and it's very exciting. So if you want to know the heartbeat of Arosha, we are not actually persuaded at all that we're going to save the world. I have shown you some really, I hope, persuasive stories of what can happen in a really short time if Christians will just take seriously this idea that the good news is for all the earth. But there's no guarantee, it seems to me, of what we might call success. We are doing this because it is second nature for Christian communities to do this. And there shouldn't be an Arosha in the world. We are not occupying an ecological niche where we're the green guys and we do that and other people just do what they do. Every Christian person, every Christian community, every Christian church should be quite naturally expressing the love of God for everything that he's made. And we would be completely out of a job. And there are signs this might happen. We started a thing in Britain 2 years ago called Eco Church, and 1,500 churches have signed up now, and we're about to launch in the USA. And I think that this is a great understanding of how every local community quite naturally expresses the good news for everything. Well, you did pretty well. I'm basically only 5 minutes over my time.
Excellent.
That's because you started in a very helpful way 10 minutes late. So we have 55 minutes for questions or disagreement or whatever you wish to do. And Miranda will also perhaps be ready to answer some of the questions, if you wouldn't mind. Yeah, straight out of the blocks.
Yes, so I'm a little bit familiar with the Rasha USA, some of their projects and so forth. What is the relationship with a structure like with a country group like Arasha USA and yourself and so forth? How does that all work?
Okay, it's a very good question. Because our model was the incarnation, that's to say the way that Jesus became a person in a particular place, in a particular time, and that is very much part of how the good news came through to us. We never tell anybody in a place or a time what to do. So we don't have a global set of programs that people join in with or sign up to. Essentially, we have 5 commitments, which I do know Miranda is going to talk about tomorrow, so I'll leave this as a trailer. But at their heart is the fact that we're a Christian organization doing conservation. They all begin with C, hopefully. But so we share these commitments, and every national organization then operationalizes that within their own country. And in fact, every local group within a national organization will decide what they want to do with those commitments and what they look like in their place, whether it's in the inner city, whether it's in the countryside, or wherever it is. And we have a quite careful process when interest comes to us from a new country. I don't think it's a secret, so I can tell you that very happily Philippines is about to launch some work, and we've been talking to them for about 7 or 8 years about what they want to do, making sure they have the relevant environmental and Christian expertise within their proposed organization. We're not a grant-making body, so we don't give out grants to national organizations. Every organization has to find its own way of living in the world. At times, some are doing well, and they become generous to others. And the new shape of Arasha, what they're calling Arasha 3.0, which will be quite soon, looks like a much more joined-up global effort with more sharing of resources and expertise and less understanding of national character. But candidly, at the beginning, we were afraid that strong Anglo-Saxon organizations would swamp the genius in other parts of the world. Ironically, that's not the case. So Arasha Ghana is probably now our most vigorous, well-staffed, well-financed organization. And Arasha USA continues to fight huge headwinds from both the church and the conservation community, and have a 2.5 full-time staff, I think, and no physical site or plant. They just have a number of really interesting local initiatives going on and interest groups. We didn't see that coming. We thought as soon as Arasha became known in the USA, it would swamp the whole lot. So we deliberately kept this Portuguese name and had a structure which was very much allowing our national organizations to take their own character. And about 10 years ago, we saw the advantages of having a more shared visual identity and a more shared set of commitments that were explicit. Arasha International, which supports all of this, is about 12 people. We have no headquarters. We all live in a local community. Miranda and I work out of our home. That saves a lot of carbon, saves a lot of overhead. But we expect a commitment to living in a form of community to be part of. I don't know.
Probably,
it's a big question.
Probably I should mention. Why don't I mention the 5?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, quickly. Because when Arasha began to grow, we didn't see this coming at all. So Arasha was Portugal from 1980 1903 through to
95.
And then came the internet, and then the word got out and it began to grow. So we had to sort of think, well, what is Arusha? What makes Arusha Arusha? And out of the collective discussion about that came an understanding of five core commitments. So something that happens in another country around the world that wants to be Arusha shares, has to sort of sign up to these five commitments. It's like our DNA, if you like. So the first, as Peter said, is a clear biblical Christian identity. That doesn't matter which country we're working in, that is the number one thing that gets put out there. Second, our business, our core business is nature conservation. So it could be a ton of other things in environmental terms, but we don't really go there, so we're not addressing climate change directly or global warming or any of those kinds of things. Our core business is nature conservation. We work in and through local communities, and I do hope to explore that a little bit more tomorrow afternoon. We work cross-culturally. That's brilliant, actually. We love the cross-cultural nature of our work. So everywhere around the world, there will tend to be a bunch of different people from different countries sort of involved in this whole thing. And we work sort of cross-culturally with each other. So within the 20, 21 different national organizations, there's a huge amount of cross-pollination and connection and so on. Is that four or five?
Four.
Okay, so the fifth one, I think we used to call it collaboration, and then it began to sound slightly sinister. So I think we now call it cooperation or something. But either way, we don't regard the work of Arusha as our kind of, you know, ours in some way. But this stuff is trying to figure out how we can live well on God's good earth and how we can be part of the solution to the crisis rather than complicit in all the destruction. And frankly, anybody anywhere who is involved in all of that, we want to be working with them and for them and alongside them and them with us. So it's a sort of, it's a real collective joined up thing that we can all do. So that's our five core things: Christian, conservation, community, cross-cultural, and cooperation. And coffee, perhaps, and chicken. And chicken and chips.
I just had a comment and then a question. I used to have like a burn on my thumb right here. And I don't have this burn anymore because my body healed itself. And I just was looking at the before and after pictures of what you were showing and thinking that's just so neat that God made the earth so it could heal itself. Mm-hmm. Just so, so cool. Mm-hmm. My question is...
Can I, before you get to your question, just say that was the great Roman Catholic theologian Hans Kung's insight. His idea of the kingdom of God was creation healed.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we think of
the resurrection of the body as our paradigm for what is going to happen to the whole of creation, that healing terminology, I like it. Mm-hmm. So now to your undoubtedly problematic question.
Yes, very problematic. One thing that I sometimes find myself facing when I think about conservation and the environment and things like that, is that I have this sort of misplaced hierarchy in my brain where I feel like I sometimes place much more emphasis in my brain upon things that involve people more than things that involve creation. So I would be, I tend to think, well, maybe world hunger, or something like that, or adoption, or those things might, like in some odd hierarchy, they fall higher in some way. And another thing that is a headwind is that I sometimes think like things in my own world crowd out the space that I desire to have for a focus or an emphasis upon, you know, mobilizing my own part in giving God's world back to Him the way He gave it to us. And so I'm wondering what, so that kind of results in a little bit of apathy, I think, about this whole thing that we've been talking about, and that's something that is problematic, to use your word. And I'm wondering, like, if you sometimes face any of these headwinds from other people, like if you find that people feel that their vision is confined to their own world, or if their vision is confined to, like, world needs that involve people. Or, like, what would you say to someone who's having a little bit of trouble getting there?
I would say I have trouble getting there. Mm-hmm. I think we're hardwired that way. I mean, I don't think this is other people's problem. I think this is my problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also constantly put the urgent in front of the important. And I think what you've described is extraordinarily natural. And I think one of the liberations for us in becoming Christians is we are free from that kind of egotism, if you like, or autism, emotional autism, that stops us from understanding beyond our experience. And one of the great pains and virtues of a Rosh Hashanah cross-cultural is you're projected into other people's worlds, and you find they see the world totally differently from the way I had to go to Thailand to become an adult Christian. I could not have become a Christian in that way back in Britain. I needed that. So I really resonate with what you're saying, and we're not free from it. I would say, however, that at a logical level, I have a Christian friend who says that Christians really should have soft hearts and hard heads, but we frequently have hard hearts and soft heads. That's to say, it's so much more appealing to deal with symptoms and stuff happening downstream, so disease and hunger and everything else, without thinking of what's driving that and doing something about the causes. So it may not seem very heroic for me to be sitting in a boardroom talking to gazillionaires, but if I can persuade them to move those millions of investment towards something beneficial rather than something destructive, that's actually going to have a landscape impact far greater than if I was in Kenya digging holes and planting trees. Do you get it? So emotionally, one doesn't have the same satisfaction. But it's important that Christians think strategically about that. And I'll give you one interesting example that moved us. On the team, I think, currently in Arusha, Canada, are a couple who were living with the poorest of the poor in India, with an organization called Servants for Asia's Poor Servants, which partners with us in several places. And they decided to leave Servants and come and work for Arusha because they said, why is everybody ending up in these appalling, enormous global slums because of the collapse of rural agriculture all over the world? There's a very strong argument that the Syrian civil war kicked off because of climate change, and the rural poor arriving in the city, their teenage adolescent kids getting into trouble with the police and trouble erupting and Assad's people cracking down, and that was the Arab Spring, and then boom. But it was really, one has to look at what's driving those things we all care about. And we do care about them. We have a daughter who lived and worked in Kenya and began a charity which now feeds 1,000 kids breakfast before they start school. So, I mean, we understand that. And you saw the Ugandan thing. So, like Miranda said, it sometimes, you know, paying kids school fees in Kenya doesn't look like environmental work, but it is. Mm-hmm. Teaching the Bible in Brazil doesn't look like environmental work, but it certainly does if sitting there is somebody, you know, with a forestry business. And these conversations happen, and they're difficult. You know. So I think we need to not just respond emotionally with bleeding hearts to symptoms, but stop and think, what can we do upstream that might heal creation rather than hurt it? I don't know if that helps, but in summary, it's not them and me, it's us. We all have that issue. Secondly, we need to be savvy and strategic as we address human suffering. And that old argument between the human development people and the environmental people was a catastrophe. And the healing of that now is actually one of the most helpful things. I see a great convergence. And I certainly, because Arosha has always...
At what level do you see that? I'd be able to do this.
I think it's happening institutionally. So we get quite a few grants from UNDP, not UNEP, United Nations Environment Programme. So UNDP realises, we just 2 weeks ago were yet again talking a lot with Tear Fund, which is a major human relief organisation, because, you know, they now understand very clearly that climate change and plastic pollution and other things are integral to solving the problems with the poorest of the poor that they face. If you want to build resilience into communities which are facing climate change or rising sea levels or something, you've got to address the environmental drivers. So I think it's been a very damaging turf war, actually, but I do see a lot of signs where there's institutional convergence and programmatic convergence. So we, you know, we're now in partnerships with many missions groups working in different parts of the world, because if they care about the communities where they work, their principal problems are environmental and they don't have that expertise. Mm-hmm. But it's a very good and it's a very honest question. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for your generation is to figure out some answers. Because we don't have an economic model that is not extractive. Mm-hmm. We don't. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how to make money without wrecking the earth. It's official. So unless you figure that out, all the great things you want to do, like building hospitals and having concerts in the Carnegie Hall, it's all over if there isn't a living planet. Mm-hmm. So go figure. You know, why is it that probably 2% of the funding that is now available for health projects around the world, medical research, is available for you environmental work, when it is estimated that climate change is probably the biggest global driver of disease now in different ways? It's because we intuitively respond to our kind and we don't get the whole thing. End of rant.
Well, on the other hand, if I might just... Well,
if I might just, by the way...
No, why don't you come up? I will be quick. But somebody said that if you pick up one bit of creation, you find it's attached to everything else. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that baffles me is that if you're talking in churches to a group of committed Christians, and you get this sort of, well, you know, I'm really busy in my Christian life. I actually have not got time to get involved in environmental things. And you're thinking, wait a second, we are actually part of creation, not outside of creation, looking in and trying to sort of look after it so that we can benefit from it. So we're actually part of this. So we're actually connected. We're actually related. And it makes no sense at all. I'll get into a rant if I'm not careful, but it makes no sense at all to say I care about the poor unless we are really ready to see that they have an environment or a natural world which is going to provide food and clean air and clean water. How can we say we care about the poor? How can we carry on living the way we do without realising that it's directly, like the butterfly effect, directly impacting the lives of the poor? So I think we've got some real conversations to have around those things, and, you know, with Christians and pastors and in churches. Mm-hmm. Say, look, how are we living our relationship with the natural world? Mm-hmm. How are we living in creation? Is it like children of God, or is it like people who don't know that it's handmade, that it's the handiwork of God? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. End of that.
I just want to say something about a time thing. That's nonsense. It's about doing things differently. Yeah. It's not about an additional thing. It's going and saying, okay, so how do we do this differently in order to be co-conservators with God, of his creation? But the other thing I want to say is, I sat this morning in Harry's restaurant having breakfast, and there was three people, and the one guy said, and there was this owl in the yard. Sorry, I'm South African, I can't do the accent. And it was looking at me, so I went to go and get a baseball bat to hit. Am I an owl in my yard? I'd be asking you a toy.
Oh my God.
But this was the mind, so mindsets. Why is an owl something that you want to kill? I said to him, well, if I had an owl in my yard, I'd be overjoyed, because the rats would see it at the end of their days. But hey. See, I'm African, what can I say? Yeah. Mind you, I believe I told somebody yesterday that KFC could do some owls.
Yes.
You've raised a very interesting point there, and it's the point of language, and it goes to the work of artists.
Yeah.
What we call things shows what we think about them, and in Britain we're having this huge debate at the moment about so-called pest species. Mm. You know, or Laura Wilkinson, who we admire hugely, we've been battling during our travels with the whole issue of plastic and what we do, and you know, you go to eat someplace and it's a plastic plate, and Miranda's been harassing this poor guy in New York over the years about his use of plastic and turning up with her plate, you know, and insisting he puts it on her plate. And I tried on the train to give my cup to the guy for a coffee, and he said, FDA regulations forbid me from filling. Anyway, but and Lauren Wilkinson always says, people say we're going to throw it away. Where's away in God's creation? Mm-hmm. So the language we use reflects the beliefs we hold.
The church that I go to in England has paper cups for coffee afterwards, on the grounds that it's too much effort to wash up ordinary cups. And I go, but that's nonsense. Actually, it's nonsense. They have a dishwasher, which is probably not very environmentally friendly. But
yeah, it does get complicated. But I think, you know, how we talk, the language we use is extraordinarily important. And we have to realize as Christians that a lot of the times the terms we're using, we're hitchhiking on concepts which don't belong. And a very brief bit of history. So the medical movement globally began out of Christian thinking right from the get-go. The care of the dying makes no economic sense whatsoever. It's not economically efficient. We do it because somewhere, residually, there's a human view of the person that comes from Western Christian thinking. The environmental movement started absent the Christians. It was a neo-political movement in the 60s, the contemporary environmental movement. We weren't involved or engaged or present. We were certainly not leading, and we're only just kind of arriving. So the mobilizing terms like ecosystem services do not do any sort of justice to what we believe about the creation. Even the word creation is extraordinarily problematic, because for most people it's just a kind of shortcut to an argument about origins. E.O. Wilson, of all people, has been trying to, who, you know, is a great, interesting person to talk to, has been trying to recover the term, because he thinks it says something, but the word environment doesn't. The term environment, like the term evangelical, has got huge baggage in your country. Environment equals socialism, I hear. I'm an environmentalist, therefore I'm a Marxist. But language is very important, and those attitudes. Yeah, so
I'm happy to report that the owl apparently flew away.
That's why God gave them wings, to get away from us.
Just learning about your work, and I think it's extraordinary. And I don't want my comment here to be taken as criticism, but with Christian faith being a basis for your organization and its beliefs and its work, is anybody concerned about it being possibly exclusionary of others who have the same kind of thinking absent Christianity? I'm thinking about Indigenous peoples around the world who really know their environment best and have had all kinds of atrocities really thrust on them by, you know, the need or the perception of capitalists to go in and make money from the resource rather than manage the resource.
I think it's a very thoughtful question, and I want to answer in two ways. The first is, I actually think that recovering the understanding that before we make any kind of religious decisions or Christian decisions for Christ, or that is not for us, before all of that, recovering an understanding that we begin in creation means that we are we,
from the beginning. Whatever we believe, wherever we live, whoever we are, whatever culture we're in, the psychological creative community comes before those choices. So that's the first thing. So when Miranda said we make community in Arosha, it's for all comers. Most visitors, I would say, within Arosha projects, most of those contributing to our effort or doing the field work for their PhDs or whatever they're doing would not call themselves Christians, but they're welcome. And for us, it's we, the community round the table.
The larger we.
Yeah.
Because so many of those indigenous people, so they may not believe in our God or, you know about Jesus. Almost all of them believe in a higher being of some sort.
That's a, yes, but it's a very complicated technical anthropological question. And one I care about deeply because it was what you would call an indigenous people group through whom I found faith. They were, as it happens, a Christian group within the Akha people in the northwest of Thailand who had not adapted their tribal ways at all, but believed in Jesus and expressed it through their culture. That's what I was saying earlier about culture, that I think we make a confusion sometimes between the appalling inroads of Western culture into indigenous cultures and finding Christ within your culture. And I think what's happening in many, I mean, if you look at the Penan people in Borneo, basically, when I showed you that map, if you look at Papua New Guinea, about 85% of Papuans are Christians, but they're living within their tribal culture and context. We were running expeditions, we discovered 200 new species in the far, far back end of Papua New Guinea, working with Christians from indigenous peoples. So I don't think indigenous cultural expression is necessarily the issue. I think it's insensitive cultural transposition. What a Chinese friend of mine calls double believing. We all double believe. Mm-hmm. We all believe as Christians and, in my case, as Brits, in your case, whatever you are. Everybody does that. But he says, if you're not Western, you don't see your double believing. So those who want to express their Christian belief within their Chineseness or within their Penanness or Arkanness, we say, well, that doesn't look very Christian. Well, it doesn't look Christian to us. But it might well be to the Lord. So this is a huge issue that you've raised. But I would say that recovering an understanding of, first of all, before everything, like Randa said, we're connected to everybody. Sorry if I'm undercutting what you're going to say tomorrow. Relief. It's we. And Christian, Arosha is absolutely not exclusionary. We do, however, believe that... Yeah, I'm just going to make one distinction. We do, however, think we can't do our work without prayer, without our Christian commitments. So those who are actually full-time engaged with Arosha, if you like, on the core staff, are required to express a commitment, their commitment to Christ, with a globally shared commitment of faith, which we sign up to. But we've had people working with us for 2 or 3 years who would not call themselves any kind of Christian. And we know they feel completely at home. We do not proselytize. We put the good news in common, primarily through the way we live, and then with explanations if people require them.
Talk about Slack.
I mean, it's a whole shared effort which we as Christians lead, but which is shared between the Sikh, Muslim, Hindu leaders with us. I mean, it's... the interesting thing is... in Lebanon, for example, you have to have your religion on your identity card. So a Western secularist who turns up and says, I just don't believe in him, and you go, no, you do, you're just not telling us. So, and actually, they're right.
It's true.
Actually, they're right. A lady birding in the park yesterday who decided at the end of the day to support Rosh, which was fantastic, she said to me, I'm just not religious. And I said to her, well, actually you are, but you haven't formalized it, to me at least. But of course you're putting the weight of your life on something. And when we were required in the World Conservation Congress to do this thing, they kind of parked us in the spirituality track, some of what we do. And I said, I'm happy to represent the Christian religion here, but if we want to think that on the platform, by having Shinto, Muslim, Hindu, and Christian leaders here, we're representing religion,
we're wrong, because the religion that is destroying the earth is the idea, the religious idea, that if I have more stuff, I'll be happier. Mm-hmm. And it's me and my life that matters more than anything else. That's a religious belief. Mm-hmm. It's the dominant one now. It's dominating politics, it's dominating everything, and it is laying waste to the earth. So let's call it by its name. Mm-hmm. That's religious. It may not be formalised, and there aren't any pretty robes or whatever. Well, there are, actually. But anyway. This is called Gautier. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to just ask, you know, in terms of theology, basic theology, you made mention of Moody in the past, and I think Moody was very much a premillennialist. And I've been more, you know, geared towards postmillennialism myself now, which would seem to just fit right in. I mean, just that if you're seeing an expansion of God's kingdom, you want to see that on all levels, you know, including, you know, creation, care, and such. And I would think that, you know, where you're at theologically within, you know, in terms of view of these things, is really going to make a huge difference in terms of the priorities that you have. Do you find that that's generally the case, or where are you in that regard?
So we have a pretty essential Christian commitment as an organization. It's basically the Nicene Creed. So, I mean, we just hold the historic Christian faith. And we do not, we don't dot I's and cross T's a great deal. That's to say, there aren't very many. There's perhaps only two of the hundreds of scientists involved who would be six-day creationists, for example. But we don't have an organizational position on that kind of thing, nor on, you know, other areas of Christian doctrine. We're a pretty broad church. And I think one of the reasons for that, if I'm really honest, is that I think you're right, but the truth about people in our experience is we live primarily out of our biography and only secondarily out of our theology a lot of the time. Justify our life choices by our theology, or we're unaware of what's really pushing us in life. It might be a broken relationship with a father. It might be the loss of a child. Darwin, for example, it looks as though Darwin's issues with Christian belief had more to do with the loss of his 10-year-old daughter than they did with any conclusions he was drawing out of his biological studies. Mm-hmm. So without wishing to relativize or minimize the importance of biblical theology, I hope you heard me clearly that I think bad theology is not just a pity, it's toxic. Without wishing to say that, we are a Christian organization embedded within the wider conservation movement, rather than working out of the Christian community to try and get out into the conservation world. And as such, we have a director of theology in churches. He works away like crazy. There's a lot of resources and all the rest. But for the reasons I was explaining to the gentleman about exclusion and inclusion, our concern is to be in common with all involved in this, whatever their beliefs, to show what the good news of Christ means to us personally and as a methodology for our work. But you're right, some forms of eschatological theology will be more helpful than others, which is why we're giving a copy of Tom Wright's Surprised by Hope to your library. And I do think, poor eschatology, various people like Andy Crouch have tried to ask why Arosha has so much trouble in the USA, and one of his answers would be very poor eschatology.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Amen. Amen. But I mean,
right.
Who am I to know? I'm a journeyman.
That's right. I'm sure
he's
right.
Yeah.
You said at one point that you think, you know, conservation needs to happen on a landscape level. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could say more about that. I think it might turn on, like, I'm not quite understanding what you mean by landscape. Maybe it's
okay.
So what do you mean by that?
According... No, I'm blanking. It's slight jet lag to her name. It'll come back. Anyway, she's basically, in a paper in Nature, looked at what she's called the four ages of conservation. And the first age of nature was nature for nature. So we saw the establishment of Yellowstone, of the early protected areas, the big national parks in Africa, and people were essentially excluded from that. They were literally moved out in Africa, and it caused tremendous problems. We work in an area in the north of Ghana in the Mole National Park, where the local communities have never recovered from being excluded from their traditional lands and were made landless, essentially, for nature. And the early nature conservationists were saying, well, if we're going to have any animals and birds and wildlife, we've just got to keep people out, and we'll create these protected areas. And when Brazil established some bits of environmental legislation, they required every landowner to set 10% aside for nature, which sounds very noble, but you've got these ecologically inert islands where species can't move from one. And with climate change, you can imagine, you know, species are moving at tens of kilometers a year now as climate changes. Well, if you're boundaried by motorways, autoroutes, and, you know, there's an ecological barrier between you and the next available habitat, and you're not a bat or something that can fly, you have a problem. And so I think we're beginning to understand the need for ecological corridors, but more than that, we're beginning to understand, if you have a golden eagle, it needs, you know, I don't know how many hundred square miles of territory. So one of the interesting new movements is called rewilding or wilding, and it's the idea that actually you can gain as much from your land by letting it just go back to natural processes and harvesting the large mammals that replace the original large mammals, so wild pigs, wild, essentially wild cattle, and just let it all go. You have none of those expensive inputs, and so you don't need your profit set against the output could be much, much less because it's set against a much lower input. And they're looking now to rewild 1 million acres of Britain in the next 5 years.
Wow.
And the great success is in the Nep estate. You can look at, there's a great book called Wilding by Isabella Tree. And I think that we're just understanding that the ages of conservation essentially went something like nature for nature, nature and people, nature for people, and now we're kind of trying to see that unless human communities can flourish, nature will never flourish. So we have to attend to human communities, otherwise they will live at the expense of nature. And that's, for the conservation movement, a branding problem. So Conservation International shifted their whole strapline to, you know, because they were the nature people, and now they realise, gosh, we're the human development people as well, otherwise we don't have any nature. Therefore, we've got to have a theory of cities and of transport, and so where's our niche? And I think that I think this is, unless, like our friend here was saying, unless this becomes something systemic to human life, that we don't flourish at the expense of nature, then our efforts to keep nature in certain places will not be enough. The way we generate energy, the way we farm, the way we fish, have all got to be done in a way that is sustainable, and they're not. Interestingly, we're subsidising what is extraordinarily unsustainable. So just simply removing the subsidies, which will save us money, could do a lot. Pernicious subsidies have a lot to answer for. But that's a political thing, why that's going on. Yeah?
I know it's speaking the second time, but
I don't think it's a rule.
Thank you. I've done some teaching on creation care in enthusiastically evangelical environments, and so I'm used to a lot of criticism, and I get a lot of the stark choice between the eagles and the babies. I don't know if you've heard that or not, you know, but I mean you've brought it up this evening, but. But I've had to really reflect and read and think about a lot of things. And one of the things that I have run into is this whole question of what is a full picture of discipleship. And this is what I've concluded is that if we don't take creation care seriously, it's like we as Christians are failing to experience a piece of training that's extremely vital to our eschatological futures. I mean, if we're going to rule with God and sum up the praises of creation to Him,
and co-rule with him over creation, shouldn't we be preparing for it? Shouldn't we be training? And that's been another intersection for me between the human side of this whole thing and nature. I'm just wondering, could you comment on that? Is that something that makes sense, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I feel myself to be very badly trained today. So, I mean, I'm sure the Lord is dreading anything I might do to the new creation. But so with that kind of rider, I think one of the big theological shifts, and to your point, that I've seen in my, I'm 67 now, so I've, you know, and I've been involved in theology as an amateur for 40 years. One of the big shifts I've seen is the understanding of what the new creation is, and you'll understand about those two Greek words, that it is kainos, it's going to be the renewed creation, not the neos, not new from nothing. There's a continuity, and Paul says that about the resurrection body, sown in dishonor, raised in, and the idea of the acorn as the kind of, when you look at an acorn, you can't imagine the tree. When you look at us in our creation now, we can't imagine the glories of the. So I struggle to conceptualize it, but I understand that the biblical burden is of continuity between what we're doing and engaged with and giving ourselves to now and what will be it in the kingdom of God, in the resurrection body and in the renewed creation. So I have no clue what it looks like. But I do know it's a consolation to some of my herpetologist friends. These are the frog enthusiasts. That although the golden frog has gone from Costa Rica, in some way they expect to re-encounter it in the new creation. Mm. And it actually gets them out of bed in the morning. Because yeah. It's pretty depressing studying amphibians at the moment. Mm. And they just feel, well, God is not going to allow anything to be lost. Nor of, you know, what is built of straw and what is built of, you know, that Paul talks about building to worthwhile things. I think just a very practical level. I was sitting next to her, because Miranda can't stand it when I'm doing email on the train, so she moved and I sat next to and into my empty seat came a student of marine biology, new to graduation, and we got chatting a bit, and I said to her, you know, you're giving your life to a good thing, thank heavens, you know, that you're not going off to try kind of just make money for yourself, you know, it's a good thing you're doing with your life. And I do think Christians should think more about the ministry of caring for creation, mm-hmm. and validate that within the mission of the church, and not just pray for people who are going to go off and preach in, you know, I don't know, wherever, Romania or whatever, but pray for the person who the next day is going to go into the EPA and wrestle with difficult environmental legislation. It's a ministry.
Absolutely. I've got a question. I think one of the themes of one of the problems for Christians taking seriously the commitment to creation is a misconception of the image of God. You know, the image of God is something that sets us apart from creation, and yet it's very clear biblically that we're both, in one sense, above creation, and that we have this power, and yet we're a part of it. We're absolutely a part of it, insofar as we're creatures looking to God. And it seems that there's a huge difficulty for Christian people to kind of accept this idea of interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. Like, that we really are, I think some of the comments of, well, you know, we should care about people, and it's almost, I've heard lots of kind of hypothetical scenarios where, like, well, if we're Christians, we've got to care for the people, you know, you only have $100 and then someone's going to die and then save the whales or whatever, and it's like, there's no, those kinds of examples seem to be setting up a false dichotomy, a false choice that doesn't want to acknowledge an interconnectedness. That actually, if you're caring for creation, you are caring for people. And it seems to me that it's only an affluent culture, usually an affluent culture, that can
that's buffered from the immediate effects of environmental degradation that can say that, that it's just a choice between people and animals, because some person somewhere is paying the environmental cost of that. It seems to me it's the poorest of the poor that are the places that are most degraded environmentally. And to me, I'm just wondering, I mean, it's a terrible thought, but with climate change actually making this reality more tangible for people who've had a cushion, seeing the effects of it, I think that's going to happen. I mean, I wish that wasn't necessary for people to accept that there's interconnectedness. I'm just going to ramble. But why is it so hard for Christians to acknowledge that we're part of creation and we're interconnected? And one thing, like Miranda was saying, you tug one thing and something, and you're tugging the whole picture.
I think it's hard because of our philosophical and theological traditions. I think that's the fruit of humanism and the Enlightenment and the autonomous being. So I think Francis Schaeffer nailed it a long time ago. To give you something, a slightly more hopeful narrative, I have a Christian friend working with many, many corporations and things around the world now on what's called the multi-capital view of business. And essentially this is believing the biblical understanding of shalom. So bear with me a moment, but this is interesting. So he says, what businesses do typically, well, always actually, is they just measure the money in and the money out. And if you think of farming as a business, it's how to turn sunlight into money through plants. And if that's in the agricultural world, or in fish, whatever, however you want to see it, but it's money in, money out. And he says, first of all, this is utterly incompetent. The things that are material to a business's success, we now know from big data, are across several different capitals. For example, if you look at the percentage of women in leadership in a company, if it's a higher percentage, you will get a big bump in staff retention. They make better managers. They make better leaders that way. If you retain staff over a long period of time, that will hit your bottom line straight out. So there's an absolute demonstrable big data link between women in leadership and profitability, but no company is managing for women in leadership or diversity. So if you're not managing for it, you don't have any control of it. It's not part of your business. So he says, and I won't give you the exact example, but essentially, if you look at a business as having financial capital, human capital, and what they call natural capital. So, if you're trying to produce a bottle of Coca-Cola, you need, 1,000 liters of water or something, at least. If you're not safeguarding your water supply, you can't assure the profitability of your production of Coca-Cola. So he says, this is the biblical understanding of everything is connected to everything, but he is a Christian as it happens, but he's working with everybody on this, and it's called integrated reporting, and it's becoming a thing, a big thing. But it's the biblical view in terms everybody can appropriate that make absolute business sense. And he says, even if you just care about the finances out, namely your profit, you better start managing for these other capitals. Mm-hmm. So to be more hopeful, I think mature capitalism, I think some understanding of how Western we are as Westerners, and the collapse of modernism and the failure of the autonomy project, actually, the loneliness, the dysfunctionality, the breakup of family, all of these things are actually pulling us towards the grain of creation. And the wisdom of God is being made apparent for the worst of reasons a lot of the time, through crisis and catastrophe, unfortunately. But truth will out, and the world is God's world, and everything is connected to everything else because we have a creator. And another big theological advance, and again it's jet lag, but I'm blanking on the name of the theologian, who is it? We spoke this morning in Texas, the community of creation, who I'm talking about. Anyway, there's been a lot of understanding now of the fact that we don't just have this particular role of priesthood within creation, but we share a day of creation with a lot of other things actually in the Genesis account. And particularly the understanding now of the importance of bacteria and everything. You know, most of what is doing what we do as a human body is actually being done by other organisms living on us and in us. That's interesting, isn't it? Which we are wiping out with antibiotics instead. So even what we understand as we physically is we creation, and we better look after it. You've got about 400 bacteria on one bit of your eyelid, apparently. We're a zoo. We are a zoo. This is where I get into. I need my medic friends at the time.
No, just in line with some things people were saying, our middle son Tim, who you met, you see, a Christian and environmentalist. I mean, he would say creation care, but he's in.
Yeah.
But we pleaded with him for a long time. He has spoken at some of the Brie conferences, and I said, you've got to do a workshop or a lecture on the environment as a pro-life issue, because of the very thing that commented back here, that so many people, how can you, while abortion is taking place, how can you care about environmental issues, you know? Babies are being aborted. And so he gave a wonderful workshop at a conference in the Pacific Northwest, I think, and just on how pro-life is a massive, abortion is obviously a key part of the pro-life movement, but pro-life, war is a pro-life issue. Mm-hmm. Clean air is a pro-life issue. Clean water is a pro-life issue. Yeah. And he just argued, and if you can't see this, then see what the Bible says about the poor, because there's so much about justice for the poor, and the poor are the ones who are who are hit the hardest by environmental degradation, by pollution, and so on. So it was great. He got quite a lot of pushback from a couple of people, particularly, but his arguments were sound.
As
and
people
part
say,
of the whole thing,
in any city of the world, the poor live downwind and downstream. Just look at it. And look at where they site industrial plants and who lives there. I read on the way over in the New York Times this huge piece about this community, which everybody knows the cancer rates are about 10 times, even in France where we were living, around the Etang de Berre with all the oil refineries. These are immigrant Muslim communities from North Africa who were placed to live there. You're not going to find the bourgeoisie living there.
Mm-hmm.
This is an issue of justice.
And
that's how the Old Testament frames that. Mm-hmm. People pushing production to the edge of the field and leaving nothing for the poor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this isn't... You cannot care for the poor if you're not concerned for where and how they live.
Yes.
And it is for Christians. I mean, there are many roads into this for Christians, but that one you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the unique problems, if I can say this gently, in your country is the politicisation of this issue. Because
polarization.
This is not a political issue. It's migrated to the left.
Absolutely.
And it's been bundled with a bunch of other things.
Absolutely.
Entirely randomly.
Exactly.
And that's a terrible shame.
Yes.
And in other parts of the world, the environment is essentially a right-wing issue. Interestingly, I would say in Britain it's more of a right-wing issue because our socialist parties tend to have urban roots and therefore an indifference to what's going on in the countryside. So it's very random.
Very interesting.
We're out of time. I can tell a look like that.
Not out of time. No, we're really grateful. Thank you all so much. Let's thank Peter as well. Please come back tomorrow morning and join us. We will.
Thank you.